Hey, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending upon where on the planet you are and when you're looking at this. I am Eric Rubenstein, and I'm the director of Advise Health's Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse, and Compliance Support Group. And this is our inaugural recording podcast. We're putting this on Advise You as absolutely free content. It's part of a series I'm doing called Retro Fraud. Each time I do one of these recordings, I'm going to be speaking to somebody that I worked with when I was at the OIG to talk about a case that was notable to that person in their career and really talk about how the fact of the matter is that a lot of the frauds that are out there are really just recycling of the fraud, and that the criminals and the people that are intent on committing fraud, waste, and abuse don't really invent new schemes. They just find new ways to repurpose them. I'm really excited about this inaugural one and the person that I've brought in to be part of this, and that's Peggy Glynn. Peggy Glynn is a retired agent like myself from the OIG. We worked together for about 25 years. She is from Buffalo, New York, which, by the way, that is my graduate alma mater. And so I'm going to turn this over to you, Peggy, for a minute to introduce yourself, and then we're going to get right into what we're going to talk about.
Okay. Thank you, Eric. Hi, as Eric said, my name is Peggy Glynn. I was born and raised in Buffalo, New York, and I worked for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office of Investigations for 28 years, 28 fun-filled years. And during the course of my investigation, I investigated civil and criminal matters. The case that Eric and I are going to talk about today was a huge civil case that was a QI-TAM, and it was run out of the Western District of New York in coordination with the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C.
Awesome. So we're going to get to that in a second. And so as Peggy indicated, Peggy is from Buffalo. I went undergrad to school in Buffalo, and I went to graduate school in Buffalo. And so Peggy and I have had this sort of kinship as a result of that connection in Buffalo. And we've been friends for a very long time, and we worked together on a variety of cases over the years and just have a great friendship. Peggy is a wealth of knowledge, particularly with cases that involve Part A cases. The case we're going to talk about today involves a company by the name of Kyphon, which was ultimately bought out by Medtronic. And that was a large QI-TAM, and it resulted in ultimately a $75 million settlement. And for those of you who get our regular newsletter or go up onto Advise's website and read the blogs that we do every week, back in January of 2020, I reached out to Peggy and I asked her if she would be kind enough to write a blog about the kyphoplasty case and this QI-TAM. So although we're giving you this sort of behind the scenes look at the investigation and the resolution for the next few moments, for those of you that are looking for some information about the sort of an overview of what the case was and maybe a little bit less of that granularity we're going to talk about today, you can go up onto our website and you can find this under the fraud spotlight and take a read on this case. So Peggy, what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit before we get to the press release and the finality of the case, if you can just sort of give an overview of what the allegation was to start.
Okay, so the QI-TAM was filed in the Western District of New York by two, as I think people understand what a relator is. It's a private citizen that brings a case to the government to be looked into. And so in this particular case, the thing that was very interesting about it was there were two relators that ended up going to the same law firm and had no idea that each one was showing up there. And so they brought an allegation against the company Kyphon that Kyphon was promoting a kyphoplasty kit to various hospitals nationwide, and the kit was expensive. However, the kit was used for what we would refer to as a minimally invasive procedure that generally could be done in an outpatient basis. But what the relators were alleging was that Kyphon was, through their sales force and through their marketing departments, was promoting to the hospitals that patients be admitted as an inpatient instead of an outpatient, And the reason for that was that at that point in time, inpatient procedures were paid higher. So for example, if a hospital had admitted Eric for a kyphoplasty procedure and admitted him as an inpatient, they could receive up to $10,000 from Medicare, versus had they admitted him as an outpatient, they would have perhaps only gotten $2,000. And the problem per se for Kyphon was they had priced the kit at $3,500, which by the way was about an 80% profit. And we're pretty much unwilling to lower that. So it was this allegation from the relators, one who was a reimbursement manager and one who was a sales rep.
So it's interesting. So this case came out of the Western District of New York, which when you look around the country, there's a 94 judicial districts, and the Western District of New York isn't a district that's inherently known for ketams. So right. For people that are following this, which are particularly lawyers and people in the healthcare fraud, waste, abuse space, the big districts where you see a lot of ketams coming out are districts that are the larger districts. Philadelphia is a huge district for pharma. Boston, for a very long time, was really the flagship district for pharma-related ketams. Some of the AUSAs in Boston are really, really good at doing them. You see ketams going into Southern and Eastern District to an extent. I worked primarily in District of New Jersey, where we had a lot of ketams as well, also with relative to the pharma industry. First, the thing that fascinates me is that two individuals went to the same law firm unbeknownst to each other, which is really an amazing fact that I actually didn't recall. But what made Western District of New York the place where these two relators or the law firm representing these two relators filed?
I think the biggest reason for that at the time was that the Western District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office had hired a new assistant United States attorney. And that gentleman was very much of the mindset that we needed to promote ourselves. We needed to make, you know, in the case of the ketam world, make law firms that do ketams interested in why would they come to Buffalo? Or why would they, you know, when they could go, like you had said, Boston, Philly, somewhere else. And the AUSA did a phenomenal job. He was basically out stumping, you know, like this is what we're, you know, this is who we are. You know, I have this team. He also did a lot of presentations and so therefore got to know a lot of attorneys and law firms through those actions. And so when this ketam came in, the law firm Phillips and Cohen, who represented the relators, knew of the Western District of New York through Robert Truziak was the AUSA, and had also done some little smaller types of work with the Western District, but it was really Robert who engaged that process for us, and that's how it came to Western New York.
Yeah, and that's interesting because when people hear that AUSAs are out stumping for business, that actually is not uncommon. When I was in New Jersey, the chief of the healthcare unit in New Jersey at the later point of my career who came in, he did the exact same thing. He was going to things like the Healthcare Compliance Association, Healthcare Right. Lawyers Association, and essentially pitching to bring cases. And what I think people sometimes don't fully understand is this issue of venue, that right. When you have a company like a Kyphon or a pharma company, the venue exists everywhere because the manufacturer is selling and promoting products at facilities to doctors, to whomever, nationwide. Whereas in some instances, a ketam can only be filed in the district because of the particular location, if it's a solo provider, for example, or, you know, if it's a local hospital, you can't right. file that ketam. You know, if it's a hospital, if it's Erie County Medical Center or Buffalo General Hospital, you can't file that ketam in the Southern District of New York. There's no venue. Venue is the requirement of venue is that there has to be an act, a bad act to trigger it. So that's interesting. So you get the case.
I think the other thing that's similar to that is one of the things that you remember, Eric, when we came on board as rookies, one of the things we were always told was go to the various agencies that, for example, HHS represents, introduce yourself, you know, basically doing the same thing. This is what we do. And I think that, you know, just as you said, that was very similar to what Robert was doing. And in this particular case, because Kaifin was nationwide, you know, the interesting thing was they're in California, the law firm was in DC, and we were in Buffalo. And, you know, because they did business nationwide, you're exactly right. We were able to establish a venue in Western District. And so therefore we were able to investigate and handle that QTAM.
So now, interestingly, you said something in the beginning about obviously this inpatient outpatient issue, that if it's done as an outpatient, the Medicare reimbursement was something like $2,000. If they stayed overnight, it was like $10,000. The device was $3,500. Was the device a separately reimbursable product, or was it just part of what the reimbursement would have been to the hospital for that particular diagnosis?
It was the diagnosis. It was,
right.
You know.
So the point being that if this was done in an outpatient setting, each time they did it, the hospital would lose $1,500 because it wasn't in their interest to use it, because the Kaifin device, the Kyphoplasty, was one of however many other types of procedures for people with degenerative disc disease, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's specifically for vertebral compression fractures, which interestingly enough, are more common in elderly women. And at that point, there was only one other procedure and instrumentation that was out there. And this was never a question of the procedure, the instrumentation. It was clearly solely based on a label, inpatient, outpatient. And one of the things that we did do in this case, which I think is important for investigators to understand, because as you well know, one day you could be looking at pharmacy case, and the next day you could be looking at an orthopedic physician, and you have to understand the dynamics and the differences between those fields of medicine. And one of the things we were able to do was actually see a kyphoplasty procedure. And one of the interesting things is a lead-in to this inpatient outpatient was that this procedure took a total, if I remember correctly, it was a little while ago, about an hour, if you will. And but most of that was positioning the instrument that they used to examine the back and make sure everything was stable and to insert the kyphoplasty kit and use it. And within, if I remember correctly, this elderly woman, probably in her 70s, went to recovery and left within, say, 5 hours. And that was the driving force behind how we investigated the case. What we looked at was, if you're going to be labeled as an inpatient, it requires a 24-hour stay, and it also requires an examination beyond the procedure. So what I mean by that is, if I'm going to admit Eric for a kyphoplasty procedure, generally speaking, this is minimally invasive. And if Eric had no other comorbidities, then generally speaking, he would be labeled as outpatient. The reason you want somebody for a minimally invasive procedure to stay overnight is because perhaps they have heart disease or they have something else that may be triggered and enhanced because of this procedure. So, you know, we began to first determine how many kyphoplasty procedures were done nationwide, you know, how much money was spent by Medicare to reimburse the facilities for those procedures. But then we zeroed it down to the data from between what we refer to as a 0-day and 1-day stay. So basically, although patients labeled as inpatient, they left the hospital in many cases well before 24 hours, which was the benchmark. And so that was the data pool, if you will, that we zoned in on.
Yeah, that's interesting. And the piece that's the most interesting to me is that Kaifon had an 80% margin on this. So at $3,500, their profit margin is huge. I'd have to do the math on that, but you're talking about a huge profit margin where to even if they lowered the price substantially and had only a 10 or a 15% margin, it would have still, you know, at $2,000. So, you know, when you're having an outpatient procedure, like knee replacements are a big one. You go and have a knee replacement as an outpatient procedure, and the hospital gets a flat amount for that procedure. If the hospital puts a $3,000 knee or a $30,000 knee in you, they don't get any more money.
Right.
And so it's in the hospital's interest to put a $3,000 knee in you versus a $30,000 knee, because they obviously want to increase their margins. And then hospitals get into, you know, things like sole source pricing, where they can get volume discounts and things of that sort. So, you know, clearly it's in Kaifon's interest to tell the doc, to tell the hospital that, you know, if you do this as an inpatient, you're going to not only cover the cost of the $3,500, but you're getting $10,000. So, you know, even if you added in the $2,000 that you would normally get, you're at $5,500. You have a $4,500 profit on top of that. Mm-hmm. So I can see it, you know, within the realm. Now, during this investigation, I know this went on for a number of years, and ultimately it was a $75 million settlement from the company that ultimately became Medtronic. But as part of this case, I remember very vividly you were racking up a lot of Marriott points and frequent flyer miles.
And Southwest miles.
Yeah. So you did a lot of traveling around the country, mm-hmm. going to different hospitals, interviewing people and the like. I think a lot of people who are enamored by FWA investigations, people that don't understand sort of the operational part of an investigation, criminal, civil, or otherwise. I have many, many conversations with people where the very first question they ask is, why do these cases take so long? I don't understand this. Tell everybody a little bit about, like why was it that you were traveling? You know, like where in the world is Peggy Glenn? What was the impetus for all of the traveling that you had to do?
So I think the first thing people need to understand is that, you know, the case comes in and the first thing you want to do, obviously, is A, determine whether or not what the relators are saying, is it really true? So in our case, you know, were there really these inpatient stays when they should have been outpatient? So, you know, was that classification, that allegation, something that had some meat on its bones, if you will? So we take a look at the data in that particular case. We had a phenomenal auditor working out of the U.S. Attorney's Office who went out and got the Medicare Part A data, you know, sifted, siphoned, you know, eliminated people that were there for, you know, over, 24 hours. So we eliminated that whole pool. And then she got it down to, you know, this pool of Part A claims that were paid to various hospitals. And so what does that mean? So what we looked at and what she was able to put together was this enormous spreadsheet that showed the number of 0 and 1 day stays versus the number of inpatient stays for that hospital, the dollar amount. And through that process, we then went back to the relators, who I have to say, Eric, you and I've worked a lot of cases, and it's fair to say that some relators, you wish you shut the door and locked it and never, ever took the complaint. These guys, along with their law firm of Phillips and Cohen, were phenomenal. They both came from two different areas of, excuse me, I'm so sorry.
A few moments later.
Hey everyone, we're back. So, you know, the world of COVID, the world of remote everything, technology, things happen. So we're going to take this up as part two of our one-part series. And Peggy, when we got disconnected, what we were talking about was relators being very good, confirmation of data, identifying that there were patients that had this as an issue, identifying the facilities. So why get on a plane and fly all over to go and do this investigation when even in the late 2010, 2007 area when we're doing this case, you could have gotten the records electronically via mail. What's your goal in getting in front of people at the hospital?
So it was a twofold reason. So as I said, the relators identified areas of geographical areas in some cases, meaning multiple hospitals in one particular area state. And they also had, in some cases, personal knowledge about the hospitals. So that was part of our direction. You know, in some cases, it was because there was this enormous number of, you know, 0 and 1 day stays that we wanted to examine. But it was also because the relators had information on a particular hospital that in, you know, our world, Eric, was really, really good stuff. So we traveled for several reasons. One was this was a nationwide case, and we wanted to get in front of people that could help us understand what was really going on the ground. And what I mean by that, it was not just hospitals that we talked to, hospital CFOs. We talked to sales reps in those particular areas. And
Let me just interrupt and ask you this. So you're going to these hospitals, you're talking to regional sales reps for Kyphon, you're talking to CFOs and things like that. Are you just showing up? Are you scheduling some of these interviews?
I think that was the most kind of interesting, one of the most interesting pieces of this case was, and I have to say, we being OIG and my particular bosses in New York were super incredibly supportive because we literally got on a plane and showed up at people's houses. If we were talking to sales reps, we walked into hospitals. We rarely had appointments to talk to anyone. We would walk right into, the administrative nurse's office and start talking about it. And some of the interesting stuff was when we started doing all this, of course, nobody knew who we were, right? Surprisingly enough, as you and I know, back in those early days, nobody knew who the OIG was. Everybody thought you were an FBI agent. And so they did. Well, when I was in there, they didn't know who we were. So we would show up. And as the more we, life is so interesting, right? So the more hospitals we showed up at, because every hospital has their, you know, their group, right? Their Western New York Hospital Association. And so the more we were out there in the field, as we'd say, we would have less and less time to get to these people, because they would start
sure,
to be.
The word is spreading.
The word is spreading.
Yep. Going to these facilities, are you guys bringing subpoenas with you? Are you serving subpoenas for documents? This is a civil case, right? Mm-hmm. So is there a criminal AOSA on this case monitoring it, or is this strictly civil?
This is a strictly civil case.
So you can't bring grand jury subpoenas. And,
that's
and a lot of people, and I've blogged about the differences in subpoenas, and I'm going to talk a lot about them as the time goes on, but there are multitude of different types of subpoenas. And some subpoenas do not allow for the compelling of testimony. They're only for documents. So if you show up with a subpoena on a civil case, outside of a grand jury case, which is criminal in nature, you're showing up with either an OIG subpoena or a HIPAA subpoena. But even in a HIPAA subpoena, you have to have a criminal AUSA involved, because the criminal AUSA is actually the criminal side is the one that signs it. So I presume that you're going with either an OIG subpoena or a civil investigative demand from the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a lot of cases, we did that. As you well know, in DHHS world, we had the request for information and assistance, mm-hmm. which was a form that we could complete. It was more of a, please help us form versus
a gentle request founded
exactly.
founded in a statutory obligation of the provider exactly. with a threat that was never carried out.
We had a lot of really good success with that. But
yeah.
we were also going in a lot of times with nothing other than, hey, Mr. CFO, can you tell me why we found this audit? And can you tell me why, in 2006, you had, 10 people that had a KIFA, had a procedure, and 10 of them were outpatient and 2 of them were inpatient. But in 2007, you had, the complete reverse of that, and
right.
nothing changed. The population didn't change. The hospital didn't pick up and move to a new geographical area. But in the beginning, when we were doing, the case against the company, a lot of where we were coming from was, please help us. We understand that this is what was happening. And so we would talk to supply, the supply people for the OR. We would talk to the OR individual nurses, again, the sales reps, and just kind of get a clearer picture of what was going on and who was really, making decisions and, in the hospital's part and for the company.
Mm-hmm.
We got emails and documents and, emails that say, don't do anything but admit this person as inpatient, and showing, sales reps coming in and putting up a, an economic model that showed nothing but inpatient.
So, in the investigative world, we always call that's the smoking gun, right? The smoking gun document that tells you what the fraud scheme is.
Exactly.
And those are typically few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
You don't normally see a smoking gun, which is why healthcare cases are sometimes a longer, more arduous process to prove, because it really is creating this roadmap of what the scheme is. It's
right.
not like there's one document that necessarily will give you a case. In a kickback case, sometimes, if there's, discussions on text or something like that, but in these traditional healthcare fraud schemes, the ability to prove the case is sometimes exacerbated by the difficulty in piecing together pieces of the puzzle. But I just want to move on because we're running a little bit out of time. But so at the end of the day, I just want to go back to what I was showing a moment ago. At the end of the day, Medtronic purchased Kyphon. Medtronic is a very well-known company in the device world. They do cardiac-related devices as well. They're a large player in the space. They purchase Kyphon, and they enter into a $75 million resolution. The relators are handsomely rewarded, right? So the typical QI-TAM in which the government intervenes is 15 to 25%. So, my math, again,
good. These guys were on the higher end of that sliding scale just because of the amount of work and the degree of information and, just how much they put into it and gave us in order to help steer that investigation. So
right.
they ended up with $14 million.
Total or each?
Total.
Total. So at $14 million, that's giving each one of the relators $7 million. I know from some of the work that we're doing at Advise, where we're working with QI-TAM lawyers, that a typical attorney fee in the QI-TAM world is somewhere between 35 and 40%.
Mm-hmm.
And then the defendant in the case usually is on the hook for the legal fees. And those can get, I think, litigious if they're really out of control. But so, you're talking about, a rather large settlement of $15 million to round up, and then the law firm winds up getting, you know, 40% of that. So you're talking about my really bad agent math would be about $6 million, you know, give or take. So you know, and then the government, you know, is getting the balance of that. And what makes a lot of cases interesting in the QTAM world is that in this case, there wasn't an issue. There was no issue of medical necessity. It was something patients needed. It actually worked. It wasn't a defective product, all of that. The issue was really how much was the government paying at the end of the day for something. And, you know, even giving the relators $15 million on a $75 million settlement, you're still talking about $60 million back to the government, which was probably a double damages calculator, if not more. And so the government was made whole, as we like to say. Plus, the side piece of this is, did individual hospitals also have to make settlements?
Yeah, and so what was really sort of fascinated and gun is when we're out investigating, you know, and talking to all these hospitals nationwide, I think we ended up in 20 states and did like 150 interviews. We began to sort of start looking at, well, wait a minute, you know, in the Medicare world, in a hospital situation, there is a, what we call like the gatekeeper. There's an individual, nurse, whoever, that's reviewing, you know, an individual's stay in their classification, and that's their purpose, to determine whether, you know, should this person really be classified as inpatient or should it be classified as outpatient. And we began to see that a lot of stuff was sort of, it was more money than medicine.
So that's it. What you're bringing up is, hospitals typically have teams of people that are called CDI folks, clinical documentation improvement, or CCS, clinical something specialist, I forget, clinical case specialist or something. But these are people who, their job, and then you've got people that are nurses that do what they call clinical validation. We'd advise do a lot of that work for hospitals and for payers. And really, yeah, those gatekeepers, CCS, clinical coding specialist. So I apologize to the CCSs of the world. There are so many different designations out there, but you're hitting on a very interesting point, which is that their job is to review the documentation in the record, identify whether or not that DRG, diagnosis related group, is accurate, and the billing is accurate, meaning that, okay, the patient was in the hospital for X, the DRG is right, the documentation supports X, and they stayed in the hospital for 7 hours, this should be coded as an outpatient. And so when I think about this case, now looking back retroactively, what I know now in my consulting world is that somebody was being told something else, or there was an override put into a system where somebody from the CDI team or the clinical documentation team was doing either their job appropriately or being instructed to do something different.
Yeah, and there were some examples of that. It wasn't just, you know, so here's an example. We had one hospital, the physician is in the operating room and he gets a call from the CFO, I believe it was the CFO, and the CFO is asking the physician if the patient has been labeled as inpatient in the middle of the procedure. So there is a lot of people involved, if you will, in this various things, you know, to include Kaifun telling hospitals, you know, there was an email I was just reviewing and it said, well, what would I tell somebody? And you know, this hospital person's asking the sales rep, and the sales rep goes, you just got to, you're inpatient, admit I'm inpatient. You know, one of the hospitals had literally photographed the hospital sign and slapped it on the cover of every kyphoplasty medical file. And it said, stop, inpatient only.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
So there was a lot of different pieces of it. You know, it wasn't just like the gatekeepers, there was a lot of other things going on in that, but they ended, you know, we ended up, I think it was 100, and I wrote it down because I knew I would forget, 125 hospitals we settled with for another $105 million. And by the way, the relators got a piece of that as well.
So it sounds to me like this case, you had a lot of stats that came out of that. Mm-hmm. So that's really good. the relators made some good money on this. What was the rationale from the U.S. Attorney's Office about why this wasn't a criminal case, in light of the fact that the company was instructing people to submit claims that were clearly fraudulent and the hospitals were clearly not just complicit, but had a financial interest in it and were actually perpetuating the fraud themselves knowingly?
Presenting or causing to present. I think in the case of the Kaifan, we just did not have enough evidence to, you know, pin it on one person, to really dig down and be able to, you know, establish that evidence and to do that. And I would say probably in the same instance with the hospitals, in the same vein, you know, there was just not enough, as we say, in the criminal world to make that happen.
And I think in today's climate, I think that if this case was prosecuted today, I think that we would have seen people in managerial positions and the like. I think we'd see people being brought out in handcuffs, because I think in today's climate, with corporate cooperation, you know, one of the this is sort of beyond this, but There's an important memo that was put out in 2015 towards the end of your time and then towards the end of mine, known as the Yates Memo, which talks about corporate cooperation, in which the days of people hiding behind the veil of LLC or INC, you know, or what we would call the C-suite, you know, that's a big term they like to use, because that's where the CFO, the CEO, the COO, the chief whatever officer, and that there was this feeling that those people were really the instruments behind the perpetuation of fraud on a corporate level, that the Yates memo essentially said that, you know, through corporate cooperation, the corporation's goal is to ferret out that fraud. It's not just in healthcare, it's in all sectors of fraud. And so I think in today's world, now this case was resolved in 2008 and then a little bit beyond, but I think that in today's climate, we wouldn't be seeing this kind of case strictly being investigated from a civil perspective.
Yeah, and you know, we looked. I mean, we took a very hard run at trying to, you know, establish some sort of criminal fraud and being able to drill down to specific individuals, but we just could not. And the thing that I think one of the things, I mean, it was a great case. I'm thankful. I have to say we had just phenomenal people working together. And that was one of the reasons it worked so well. We just had a good team and everybody had their role and everybody was very good at it. But as a result of what we were able to do with this, that one day, 24-hour stay was changed. So inpatient now required a 2-midnight stay. So you had to be over 2 days. It also led to what people started to say, low-hanging fruit. So now, you know, we were looking at a kyphoplasty procedure. So some really good investigators in other states around the country started looking, going, well, I wonder what other procedures are doing this? And so a lot of other cases came out of that. We refer to it as a one-day stay, you know, inpatient right. versus outpatient. So, you know, in addition to what our settlements were and also Kaifan was entered into a corporate integrity agreement or Medtronix. I think the standard's about 5 years, mm-hmm. you know, so they were being scrutinized by DOJ and had to meet certain milestones each year and do so many audits and stuff. And right. I think it, think the other thing that it also brought to light was there, when we began the hospital case, and I know we have to go, but when we began the hospital case, there was only one hospital that looked at that Kaifan settlement and went, oh boy, we might want to look at our, right? We might want to look at our stuff. And so they came to us. They said, we looked, we came, and nobody else really did that. No other hospitals took the initiative. But like, we just settled this huge case. It was, you know, everyone was talking.
Nobody as a result sought out a self-disclosure.
Right. They didn't look.
Right.
You know, they weren't looking, actively looking until we were like knocking on their door.
Sure. So that gets back to something I say constantly to advise clients, which is you want to be a penny wise and a pound foolish. You can't do that, or you can't say, well, you know, you can't see me. You can't see me. It's kind
right.
of, you know, the right. bit. So we've got to wrap up, but I have two quick questions. My first one is, what was the most exotic place that you had to go to in the United States for this case?
Hmm.
Did you go to Hawaii?
No. I think that, if you want to call California exotic, on a horse farm. I interviewed a doctor who was, I interviewed a doctor who we were tracking down. He wasn't at the hospital, so we ended up on his horse farm. And in the middle of our interview, he started to go down, like literally go down, and he was experiencing kidney stones. So there was, so.
Did you get to rope a cow? And then,
yeah.
And then the converse is, what was the crappiest place you had to go to?
Oh God. I can't even, it was probably just some podunk hospital, like trying to, I can't specifically say, but there were some moments where we were trained investigator, and we'd be driving in circles trying to find, like when we were trying to find sales reps, you know, we were like driving in circles trying to find the address because there were some markings and a lot like that in Texas where you'd end up on some road backwoods.
You have to make a right at the barn and a left at the fork in the
literally.
Road. Literally. If there was a barn at the fork of the road, you just sat there and cried.
Yeah, it was.
I get it.
It was a great case, though. I mean, like I said, it was a great case. So.
Well, Peggy, we're out of time, but I do want to thank you very much for doing this. Again, this was the inaugural trek down retro fraud. As time goes on, I'm going to be doing a lot more of these. There are going to be interviews with other people similar to yourself. I'm going to have you back because I do want to talk about other cases because you had a long career, 28 years. It wasn't just Kaifan. Buffalo was an interesting place to do a lot of cases. You had to travel to a lot of different places, a little bit different cases that come out, not just your sort of run-of-the-mill Medicare, Medicaid stuff. So I'm gonna have you on again and pick your brain about some other stuff. Thanks, everybody, for joining this first foray into retro fraud. Again, I'm Eric Rubenstein. I'm the Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support for Advise. And thanks for joining us here at Advise Year.
Bye, guys.